Okay. We talked about the direction problem. Another issue when it comes to saying something about causal relationships between variables are what we usually refer to as the third variable problem, or maybe confounding variables. That's also a term you will see now and then. So instead of there being a relationship between one independent and a dependent variable, maybe something completely different is taking place here. The example I have here is maybe a little bit odd, but it's it may illustrate what we are dealing with, and you will be able to try this out on a different problem a bit later. So for instance, in a study I did some I had a large data set with variables from a health survey among Norwegian teenagers in their region, and one of the this is something, it's a very large project which is carried out every fourth year in different regions of Norway. It's a national health survey, and in that survey you add a number of different questionnaires to approach things in different ways. And one of the things we did was to introduce some kind of a questionnaire that had to do with the measurements of sensation seeking. Whether you are a person that enjoys new stimuli all the time, you enjoy driving fast in cars, you enjoy uncertainties in life, you enjoy watching violence on television. There is a number of these types of questions, or new things, and new things, or scary things. You would like to jump in a parachute. You're a climber, or you like to climb mountains. So this defines you in different ways as a sensation seeker or not a sensation seeker. It's actually defined in two. Then you can either be a news seeker or a stimuli seeker, and people are varying quite a lot on this range, on this scale. So, but what we found here, we found a number of. I'm taking a curious one now. We found a number of relationships between sensation seeking and different, you could say, lifestyles and health issues. For instance, we found a relationship between how early you had your sexual debut and how much of a sensation seeker you were. We found relationships between other sexual behaviors and how much of a sensation seeker you were over different age groups. And an obvious thing to say then is that since being a sensation seeker predicts these behaviors, could be something else. But what also was the cause here, or what's the case here, was that there is an even stronger, of course, relationship between age and these things. And there is an even strong, and there is a strong relationship between age and sensation seeking. So, what we then, the first effect was actually quite small, the relationship between sensation seeking and these behaviors. So when we control statistically, and that is a strategy one can use, when we control for this statistically, we found that the effect of sensation-seeking disappeared completely in the equation. Age is much more important as as a link to both sexual behaviors and, in this case, sensation seeking. The older you are, the less of a sensation seeker you are. But if you're young enough, neither are you a sensation seeker. So it's a kind of a U-curve, or a switched U-curve, where you are, at least boys, especially boys, are very sensation-seeking in their late adulthood and early, when they're between, let's say, 14, 15 and 24, 25. That's when they're at their peak as sensation-seekers. And that's more important than sensation seeking as a predictor then. And this is, of course, a type of new, where you nuance this and discuss it and actually find what's the true cause here. Let's just go back a few slides here. What are the threats to causality? I gave you we had this example of this attitude campaign that seemed to work. Let's say it worked. Let's say we were able to measure a link between putting up posters on the road from here to Lillehammer. We did put up posters, and we counted, or we measured speed of every driver for a certain period or something. And we concluded that, yes, the average speed had dropped 5 kilometers an hour. The number of speeders had dropped from 10% to 7%, and this is statistically significant and important for us. So this is what we found in this study. This is purely hypothetical. Can we be certain that the attitude campaign was the cause of this? Any suggestions? Yes? Weather conditions? Yeah, maybe the weather was different in this period. Maybe the before measure was on a nice summer day, while the after measurement was done in later in the autumn, for instance. That's usually called, it could be maturation or history. Something has happened over time that has caused changes to this. What could we do then to control for that? Suggestions? Then you have a hypothesis that it's the visibility of the boards that is the effect here. I would say that it's the conditions of the streets. Yeah, that was a creative solution at least. other comments? Blue, back first. Yeah. That's the control group approach. You do a before and after measurement on a similar street where you haven't done this. Good. So that's one approach. Other suggestions? Yeah? Come on. No, it's you. Yeah. Repeated measurements is usually what we refer to there. With we make a timeline and do repeated measurements and control things by measuring at a number of points in time. Yes, that's a strategy. I would say being more specific, for instance, on how to measure things is also a possibility here, that you actually measure the same type in under the same type of weather conditions on two occasions. Okay, is the only threat to the conclusion of a relationship between the attitude campaign and actual speeding is that bad weather, or do you have any other suggestions there? Maturation. I'm just referring to the terms on the slide here. People have gotten better cars over time. I hope we don't have that much of a lack between. Yeah, that's another thing. I'll provide you with a couple of other solutions here as well. Maybe some accident happened last week. That's also a history thing. So there are a number of these other factors that may affect such a result, and you've been good now at approaching this in different ways. We can measure things at several points. We can add control groups. We can measure, let's say we measure the weather in addition, so that we actually have, or we measure the friction on the road or something, so that we have an additional variable that we can introduce into the statistical analysis to control for. That would be the quantitative approach to this when we describe a phenomena like this. So there's a number of different approaches to this. Some of this has to do with history, or most of the factors we've talked about now has to do with history. One effect that we should be aware of as well, that may affect results or affect the relationship between an independent and a dependent variable, is maturation. You were approaching this when you said that people have gotten better cars in between the first test and the second test. A good example of maturation, which is more obvious, is if you measure reading skills among kids, for instance. If you measure reading skills before and after you did something in school, and time has passed, well, time also makes kids better readers or better problem solvers or whatever. So the fact that they actually grow and becomes older itself is enough in this setting. So that's used to refer to as maturation effects. We may have test effects. The fact that you actually observe someone, if we take this example with the speeding on the road between here and Lillehammer, maybe the fact that a number of observers being dressed in yellow reflex shirts or something along the street reduces speed itself. In many test situations, people are aware that they're being measured or something. And being aware that now we are measuring you is an extremely strong motivator in different ways. Changes in the measurement instrument were somehow referred to here. Maybe the way we measure speed has become better. Probably not, because that's a basic thing. But in many of your type of experiments, where you, well, maybe the test equipment has become better. Lag caused by slow processors or lack of memory or something like that has been reduced. So that measurements actually are different in itself. Regression effects, that's purely statistical phenomena. Every type of, if you make one observation, it's likely that the next observation is more towards the true value of a variable than the first one. Because one observation may be an extreme, but if you take the sum of several observations, you get closer to the true value. So when you do only one before observation, there is a tendency, it's more likely that the next value you measure is more towards the mean than it's more extreme. That's the nature of observations that falls into a normal distribution, as you often refer to as regression effects. Maybe I'll get back to it when we are talking about the normal distribution. So, and that is a phenomena that's often overlooked when you do measurements and draw conclusions. It's compensated for by doing more than one observation, of course. So, one strategy is to approach this as somewhat like you suggested here by adding several measurement points, and that is a good control of these factors. A third variable, or a spurious variable, or a confounding variable, might affect the dependent variable in several ways. So in this way of formulating this, there is a relationship between an independent variable X and a dependent variable Y. And then we have this variable set, which may be unrelated or related to the phenomena or the relationship we are observing. In an ideal setting, of course, this third variable is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have anything to do with the situation. But when it has something to do with the situation, it may be affecting the situation in several ways. And often it's important to be aware of actually how a third variable affects the outcome of a situation. The C can be a contributory cause of a relationship. So maybe both these variables affect the dependent variable in some way. Or maybe this variable needs to be there for a relationship to occur. So maybe H, let's say that this is H. And for the attitude campaign on speeding to actually work, H must be above a certain level or something like that. It can be an intermediary thing, so that the independent variable actually affects this variable, and changes in this third variable is what causes the final effect. Then it's of course important to discover what this factor is, because that is actually then the factor that changes the dependent variable. Or it can be, as some of the examples we gave in the beginning there with spurious correlations, there is a back background factor here that may affect both both variables, but the variables it affects, the independent and the dependent variable, is independent themselves, or they doesn't affect each other. How do we control for it? We have mentioned this already, but I can try to be more precise on it. As a at least measure several variables. Make sure that you measure them so that you can apply statistical methods to isolate the effect in a better way. Try to be reductive. Try to reduce the number of factors that's involved in a study whenever that is possible. In a real life setting, that's often very difficult. You often have a lot of factors. There are other people, there are weather, there are other situations, there are learning, there are media. A lot of things are happening. So it may be very difficult, but in a laboratory setting where you want to check for relationship between variables, it's a lot easier. Take out all the variables you don't want to investigate in this connection. Establish a relationship between a cause and effect in an isolated setting first. And then try to widen things out. But that is maybe a next step. That is a natural next step in this process. So don't approach this in a holistic manner right away. Be reductionistic and try to have a more focused approach to it. Control groups is also a strategy, of course, to isolate variables in this setting. But at least plan your data uptake. It's very easy to be, when you discover things that didn't fit or happen afterwards, and actually didn't measure the right data. Maybe you forgot to measure age, maybe you forgot to measure people's educational levels, maybe you forgot to measure previous experiences with different types of software. Maybe you forgot a lot of these things. And when you forget these things, it's very difficult to correct for them afterwards. Plan your data collection. Okay. Try to break things up a little. Try to do that and then be as... not fill every minute of the 45 minutes with my talk. I'm a psychologist, as you know. So let's... We started out last time with some... I gave you some problems to solve that had something to do with how humans are as information collectors, how good we are at discovering things in the on the world around us. Another group of these types demonstrations of our difficulties as information processors has to do with how good we are at actually analyzing problems and get to the right conclusions. It's often called problem solving in psychology. Let's see if I can take this one. I'll give you a task to solve here. It's probably very difficult to read, isn't it? If I can bring it up in PowerPoint instead, maybe. Like that. This is a problem, it's an old one. It's been used a lot in research. You're a doctor and you're faced with a patient who has a tumor, cancer tumor. It's in a position where it's impossible to operate this tumor out of the patient. But radiation may kill the tumor here. The problem is that you need a sufficient energy in the radiation that you apply to be certain that you actually cure the tumor, or that you kill the tumor that's inside the stomach. The problem then is that when you apply that, you kill the tissue around the tumor as well, on the way in and out. If you reduce the energy level of this radiation to a safe level, well, then you don't kill the tumor either. So how can this be solved? How can the doctor apply a procedure that kills the tumor, but at the same time avoids destroying healthy tissue? That's your task. 2 minutes with your colleagues here. Okay, let's stop there. Maybe we can start on the front here. Any suggestions on the side here? No? Okay, anyone? Any solution? Second row? You had discussions here? Any suggestions, even though we couldn't get the solution? Yeah? You try to open up and... It's not a strategy the doctor would have used in this case, but it could have been done, I'm not sure. In the back? At different times, or... We'll get back to it. I'll just give you some additional information here, because when of course you have a little bit of more information now. This is a common procedure. It wasn't a common procedure in 1945. So there are ways of solving this, but there were the same. It's more or less the same strategies they used in the early days. When Dunker showed this problem to a population, he did this repeatedly, and he had created a lot of these types of problems. He found that only 10% of the population actually were able to solve it. This has increased over time. I've heard numbers now referring to 30% or something, but it's still not very common. Most people can't solve this as an obvious thing, unless you're given a little bit of assistance. I'm not sure if you noticed, but in the beginning here, some of you maybe saw it, I'm not sure. I used, if I can find it. Maybe in Firefox. Yeah, this one. This is a very similar problem. And if I hinted to you, and I've done this already now, that this is an analog problem to the problem that we had in the first case. The number of people to solve it will probably increase to 80% or something. When you read this and hear that this solution that I show you here, the Red Adair thing, do you get this answer now? Okay, what do you think is the solution to the that focuses and reaches the point at one point? So I noticed that some of you actually answered it. I heard that some got to the right answer early on. So what you do is that you split the lethal dose into several doses, and they meet at a certain point, at the focus point, where the tissue gets damaged, but not the other points around. And this is how radiation therapy works. The point with this is that solving analog questions helps us gather information in a better way. So approaching things from different areas, getting a lot of information from similar areas, how others have solved things, may clear things up a lot for us. But once put in a situation where we don't know the area very well, as is the case here, and where we tend to, what we tend to do is that we relate on previous experiences, and that often complicates the solution we get to. Because I'm sure we could safely say it's a complicated procedure if you were to try to operate an isolated tumor and then put radiation into the tumor or something like that. That's a complication. And a lot of our problem solving, when we're trying to analyze the world and when we're trying to get to conclusions on cause-effect relationships, has to do with being too complicated in our approach. A simple solution is quite often the correct one. Okay, I'll try to introduce a few more of these later. back to today's topic. The next term we're going to talk about is reliability and validity, because that is also questions that I ask you to discuss in the first essay that you're going to do. I'll present the task for next essay, but let me give you a short thing on it. What I want you to do is that you will be given two short essays, which I want you to analyze, where I want you to identify dependent and independent variables. I want you to reflect on the operationalization of the variables in those papers, and I want you to reflect on the two terms, reliability and validity, when it comes to conclusions in those papers, the relationship between the independent and the dependent variable. And reliability and validity has to do with, well, firstly, reliability is defined as the extent to which a measurements give consistent results. When you measure the same thing again, will it measure the same? In a technical setting, this may not be the case, but it can be the case there as well. But a good example of a reliable measurement is a mechanical or maybe also an electronic measurement of the rotation speeds of wheels, transferred into kilometers an hour. So the speedometer of a car should give you the same number every time you drive in a given speed. If it does, then it's a reliable instrument. Its measurements is reliable. A timer on a computer may not be that reliable always, or CPU usage or something like that may not be that reliable, because other factors may influence it. So in comparable situations, you may get somewhat difficult or different answers. Could be. But where it really has effect is on observations and on the use of questionnaires, for instance, where different observers or over different situations on different times of the day, whatever, you can measure something different. You can measure the same situation in a different way. Then you have low reliability of your instrument if it doesn't measure the same when you repeat things. But to continue the speedometer analogy, even though the speedometer shows 80 kilometers an hour every time you drive at a given speed, the speed isn't necessarily 80 kilometers an hour, right? It can give you a false measurement. So the reliability may be high, but say that it shows you 80 even though the speed is 72 or something. That's a safe way of handling these situations, and it's quite common in cars. Well, then you have a lack of validity. And validity has to do with the extent to which a concept, a conclusion, or a measurement is well-founded and corresponds with the real world. So in Norwegian, if you can translate this into pålitelighet, reliabilitet, reliability, pålitelighet, while validity is gyldighet. these the translated terms. So something can be reliable and not valid. And in some very obscure situation, things may also be valid without actually being reliable. But that's special cases. So the general approach to this is that reliability is a prerequisite. It's necessary to have for to create a valid situation or valid conclusions. This is just a way to summarize this in four instances where you on the upper row here can have a reliable measurement even though you don't hit the target, which may be a situation you can control for. If you know the deviation, you can compensate for a speed measurement that's 5 kilometers off. That's just a linear function. So lack of validity can now and then be quite easily compensated for. While lack of reliability is harder to compensate for. There is one way to compensate for it that's used in statistics, and that is to add a huge number of observations. So adding observations will help you to, in this case here, where you actually had a valid measurement, say that the true value is in the center here. So you get a normal distribution around a center value. And now and then we use this strategy, but it may be difficult and it may be very costly to compensate for it. So strive for high reliability. That's the general advice in situations like this. So next time I will probably start by talking about or more about the different types of validity and threats to validity. Okay, that's all for today, folks. Thanks.